He was very much under control and moved with great dignity and certainty of...
He was 15 yards away now, headed directly toward us.
The Reverend suggested we yield the path.
The Reverend, having strong feelings about the impropriety of allowing oneself to be passed through.
The man reached the white stone home and let himself in with a key, the lad then following him in.
Mr. Bevins, Mr. Volman, and I, concerned for the boy's welfare, moved into the doorway.
The man then did something. I do not quite know how to...
He was a large fellow, quite strong apparently, strong enough to be able to slide the boy's...
sick box.
The man slid the box out of the slot in the wall and set it down upon the floor.
And opened it.
Kneeling before the box, the man looked down upon that which...
He looked down upon the lad's prone form in the sick box.
Yes.
At which point, he sobbed.
That's an excerpt from the Audible Studios production of Lincoln in the Bardo by George Saunders. He's the New York Times best-selling author of the short story collection 10th of December and National Book Award nominee. He won the Folio Prize and he was awarded a MacArthur Fellowship. And now, this acclaimed author has won the most prestigious literary prize in the English-speaking world, the Man Booker, for his debut novel, Lincoln in the Bardo, which tells the story of Abraham Lincoln's grief after the death of his young son and his visits to his tomb. George Saunders, welcome to The Big Interview.
So nice to be here. Thank you.
We're really, really pleased that you could make it because, of course, just a couple of days ago you won the Man Booker, which is absolutely huge, really, anywhere in the world that speaks English. Is it slightly overwhelming?
It's more than overwhelming. Yeah, I had no idea, so I'm struggling for purchase, but having a lot of fun in the process.
Well, it's a long way from Chicago in the 1950s, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Yeah.
And that's where I'd like to go back to, because I understand that your backstory involves chickens.
Yeah, when I was in high school, my father had been actually a coal salesman. He sold coal to sort of a salesman to buildings. And so to get out of that, he opened, bought a franchise restaurant called Chicken Unlimited. And our motto was Chicken Unlimited doesn't stop at chicken. So we were on the south side, kind of working class area, and my whole family worked there. All my friends worked there, and I was the delivery boy. So it was kind of a great job for a writer because every night you'd go into 40 or 50 houses to deliver the chicken and hear a little snippet of each person's story and see the way their house looked and how it smelled. And it was lovely. Kind of.
Where did Chicken Unlimited stop?
Nowhere. Well, actually, it stopped about 6 years later. There was my dad led a lawsuit against the franchise because contractually it was almost impossible for an individual franchisee to make any money. So he sort of led a revolution and then that dissolved the chain.
So in fact, that's where
that's
Chicken
Unlimited stopped. It stopped beyond chicken.
But when you were hearing all of those stories and really gathering all that information, did you have a sense then that you wanted to be a writer?
I did. Yeah. I had an English teacher that I just adored. Sherry Limlum was her name. And she, and this is in the 70s. And I remember her showing these kind of film strips of writers. And there was one of, I think it was supposed to be Nathaniel Hawthorne, kind of a cartoon of Hawthorne. But she said something about the writer is sort of an open receiver that receives his or her culture and then interprets it. And that even as a 16-year-old kid, that was so intriguing to me that a person could be completely open to the world and somehow make sense of it. And also the fact that she was clearly an admirer of this profession, that kind of got into me, and I thought, oh, maybe I should do that. But I didn't know any writers, didn't know anyone who was a working artist, so it kind of took a very long path to get there.
But, mm-hmm. Yeah. But in 1986, off you went to college.
Right. I'd gone to engineering school. Then.
So for somebody who wanted to be a writer, that's a slightly odd decision.
Yeah. I think it was from that particular social class and world, I didn't know I wanted to be a writer. I didn't even know it was allowed. It was sort of a half dream, but I'd never seen it actualized, so I didn't know how to proceed. And in fact, for me, I wasn't even going to go to college. I was in a band, and that was the big career plan.
What did you play?
I played guitar. It was fun. I knew a guy who knew a guy who knew a guy who knew somebody in the Eagles. So that was sort of basically an inside connection. My family, generally, we didn't go to college. But then this high school teacher and her soon-to-be husband kind of conspired to get me into college. And they actually called the college I eventually went to and sort of pleading my case. And so I went to college. And the only this particular college was an engineering school, so I got an engineering degree. And, you know, I was reading all along, and I really only lit up as a person when I was reading, but wasn't smart enough to make the connection that, therefore, that's what I should do with my life. I just desperately didn't want to fail college for their sake and for my parents' sake. So it was only after I got through the engineering degree, went to Asia, and was working in the oil fields, and had more time to read, and slowly it started to dawn on me that if something totally lights you up as a human being, that might be what what you want to do with your life. Yeah.
Now, I know you didn't pursue it, so it's probably not that important to you, but what were you doing in the oil field?
I was trained in what's called exploration geophysics, so it's basically seismic. You blow off a charge of dynamite and record the vibrations, then you can prospect for oil. So we were deep in the jungles of Sumatra looking for oil, basically. Yeah.
So that very technical work, did it influence how you write, you
Yes,
think?
Absolutely. I actually think that at least the short story is an intensely logical form. You know, that your job is to go ahead of the reader, eliminate the less meaningful corridors, stay in the main one while appearing to be spontaneous. But it's very much like a mathematical proof, albeit with some decoration. So that really helped. And the second thing is that in engineering school, they would give us the speech, you know, look to your left, look to your right. There's only me one of you left at the end of this. We're here to flunk you out of school. One of the kind of catchphrases at this school, the Colorado School of Mines, was no partial credit. So you could do a 4-page proof, and if the answer was off by a couple digits, that was 0 credit.
Wow.
So brutal. But also for a writer, you know, if you do 600 drafts and the result is not working, no partial credit. When I got to that realization as a writer, it didn't frighten me. I thought, yeah, that makes sense. You know, if this is really as beautiful a pursuit as we know it is, then you don't get any credit for trying. You really don't. You only get credit for the beauty that you've actually made. Fair enough. Yeah.
And that whole sort of scientific process of cutting to the chase with no kind of extra fat on it must be very useful when it comes to short stories where it's always trim, trim,
exactly,
trim.
Exactly right. You know, sometimes in the middle of a proof, you get the feeling that you're just channeling this organic truth, this organic system that's out there. It's coming through your body onto the page. And that, in turn, makes you a little bit respectful of the fact that the surface mind is not the only mind. You know, the mind that we think with every day and we get a car and we shop for groceries, that mind is very functional.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a deeper mind that we have access to that's 100% as real, more capacious, more unpredictable. So for me, that I first intuited that mind maybe through these proofs and the science, but then when writing, you really feel it. So I think for me, so much of the process of writing is to say, okay, George, get out of the way. There's this other thing that you have access to. You have to believe in it for it to come. It only comes through work, through revision. But having written story for so many years, I know it's there. It's reliable, and it's smarter than I am, and it's sort of an addictive relationship to let that thing come through.
And so a lot of that you learned at college where you went in the mid-80s. Mm-hmm. That's also where you met your wife. You were engaged within 3 weeks.
Yes. This was actually, after engineering school, I did a bunch of sort of beatniking around and ended up at Syracuse in the creative writing program. And so I came into town with a strong resolution, 2 years to pursue my craft, no women, no fun, and then met my wife, and we got engaged in 3 weeks.
That's very fast.
It was just the right pace. We just had our 30th anniversary, but it was something very strange. You know, we were kind of definitely from different worlds, and we weren't really weren't each other's type, essentially, but it was just this kind of strange bonding that we both needed each other, and we both had some kind of completion to do, maybe from past lives or something. I don't know. But
you've written a lot about and spoken a lot about the importance of empathy and kindness, and particularly in your graduation speech from Syracuse, and that kind of went viral, didn't it?
It did, yeah.
So tell me the gist of it.
Well, the gist of it is that, you know, at this age, you look back and you think, well, maybe there's a form of wisdom in just saying, what do I really regret? What if I could go back and change anything about my life? You know, I've done a lot of embarrassing things and a lot of really awkward, had a mullet at one point, you know, that kind of thing. So
you can be forgiven.
Yeah, I think so. But I don't care. That to me is all funny. But when I go back and look at the times when I had what I call a failure of kindness, those things land hard. And in the speech, I pulled out the least egregious, you know, example. As a way of proceeding through your life, if you look back and you think, where are the real sticking points? For me, the moments when, out of a kind of almost laziness, you just don't see the person in front of you as fully as you should, you know. And, you know, we have like an endless capacity to empathize with one another, but we don't do it. We're busy. You know, we're agitated, we're anxious. And so the speech was kind of about that. And interestingly, you know, I had to write it pretty quickly, and I had given a version of it to our daughter's middle school class. So 2 or 3 days before, I thought, oh, I'll just find that and read it. And I couldn't find it. So I had to rewrite it and wrote it actually much more simply than I write other things. And then it went viral. So there's some lesson in that that I haven't quite processed yet.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, some of the other things you write focus on the absurdity of consumerism, of corporate culture, and also the role of mass media. Mm-hmm. And that the whole way that empathy feeds into this, I suppose, is looking at how divisive our society is right now. I mean, the things that you had to say then are so important to us now, particularly considering all these other themes that come up again and again in your work.
For me, what I'm thinking about these days is there are many different modes of thought. In a given day, we think with several different minds. Now, social media has been invented. We've all embraced it very joyfully. But if you look closely at the way your mind feels on social media, I think you would have a hard time not concluding that it reduces us. You know, when I'm on social media, it's always the quick response, the pithy put down. That's not actually the mind at its best. So I think that has been a kind of recurring theme, is that if we, at certain moments in our life, we've all had a large mind. You know, when somebody passes away, for example, you have that incredible transparency of feeling. When you have a child or whatever, that mind is very lovely and wonderful, and you can actually choose to occupy that mind. You can enlarge that part of your mind. And I think it's strange that, you know, at this point we're submitting to this new thing that I think is actually a little toxic. And if I look at the way I feel when I've been texting all day, I feel reduced. So I think it's a bit of a strange, it's almost like you let in this stranger. Come on in, you're so seductive. But that stranger is actually corporate. All these platforms are corporate entities that have an agenda, a concealed agenda. And now they're actually working in our minds and our bodies with our consent, but maybe without our full understanding at this point.
What about that from a philosophical standpoint? So I know that you considered yourself an objectivist in your 20s.
A long time ago, yeah.
I mean, but not any longer. In fact, you've gone towards Buddhism.
Yes. I suppose a Buddhist standpoint would be do something and see how you feel. You know, if you eat 15 chocolate bars, you're certainly allowed to do that, and then you notice that it doesn't feel very good. That's a form of philosophy. So for me, with the social media, I'm, you know, having written a novel, you know, finally, and watching the way that felt in my mind and my body, I it was wonderful, you know, to feel that way. You know, philosophically, I think that the best philosophy is to watch your own mind. You know, see how it feels under different stimuli.
Mm-hmm. So Buddhism, of course, brings us to bardo, which is a Buddhist term for a place some call purgatory. But before we get onto your novel, because, of course, the title is Lincoln in the Bardo, I want to play writer roulette.
Oh, boy.
So I'm going to ask you a series of quick-fire questions, and you just have to hope that you don't get the dud one.
Okay. Oh, boy.
Okay, you ready?
Yeah.
Yeah. Silence or music?
Music.
Writing day or night?
Yes.
Cafe or study?
Study.
Carefully constructed writing schedule or ad hoc scribbling?
Ad hoc schedule.
Coffee or tea?
Coffee.
Pen and ink or mouse and screen?
Screen.
And now, I'm afraid you have triggered the dud bullet.
Okay.
Here it comes. I know you're happily married, but give me your Tinder profile in 2 sentences.
What's Tinder?
Brilliant answer. Now, this book is, in fact, the result of something that your wife, who you didn't find on Tinder,
right,
has been going on at you about. Because this book, this fantastic book, this prize-winning book, Lincoln in the Bardo, has been bubbling under for 20 years. All of this time when you've been getting acclaim as this fantastic short story writer, there was this amazing novel waiting to be born. Why did it take so long?
I think I was building the skills, actually. You know, the it's a pretty deep idea, and it's a pretty straight idea for me. And so there's a little hard-to-describe process. You think of a notion or even a sort of a conceptual idea for a story or a book. That's fine. And then a voice either arrives or it doesn't. And if it doesn't and I proceed, I always get in trouble. It's almost at the back of my throat. There's just a feeling that I could do a voice to serve that idea. If that doesn't happen, I know to run away, because then the only thing I have to proceed with is concepts, and it's dead. So with this book, I just couldn't, there was no voice apparatus that suggested itself for all that time. And so the one thing I had learned is don't proceed if that isn't there. Mm-hmm. You know, as a sort of guilty experiment, I tried to write a play, and that was just proof that there's no voice. So I think two things happened. One was that I got older. You know, our kids grew up, and I became more confident of what I would call like the positive valence of life. You know, when you're young, it's easy to doubt, disparage, satirize, and those are valid things to do always. But it's harder, I think, to sort of praise the positive things of life. It's just technically harder for some reason. But as I got older and I started to see the sort of full range of experience, I got more confident in that trying to express the positive valences of life was important, and that it shouldn't rule out stylistic panache, you know? Mm. Then also I was doing a lot of nonfiction pieces that were reinforcing that idea, showing me how to write fairly calm things or just physical descriptions, for example. So that was happening. And then there were a couple of little triggers. I had a former student who said, just offhandedly, he said, I thought if you ever write a novel, it'll be a collection of monologues. And when he said that, something in me just went, oh, yeah, that would be fun, you know.
Mm-hmm. And because, then, of course, this is written in block quotes,
right,
isn't it?
Right.
Yeah.
And that approach resonates with my philosophical standpoint, which is that if you want to know what God thinks of the world, to my way of thinking, God sees us as a bunch of monologues, you know. Mm-hmm. Two people sitting on the bus having their intense monkey mind experiences that are almost not related to the physical reality. That's kind of a beautiful picture of reality, you know. Mm-hmm. Millions of thought streams going off at once. So the book is sort of a mimicry of that.
Tell me where it came from.
20 years ago, we heard this anecdote that Lincoln had been so grief-stricken, he went into his son's crypt a few days after the burial and held the body. Now, whether that's true or not, I don't know. It was in the newspapers that he had entered the crypt. That was just the thought. So over the years, I kept thinking, well, how did he do it? How did he get in there? Was he alone? Why did he do it? Why did he stop doing it? How did that alter his trajectory as president? And I kind of just mused on that for 20 years and did some light research, you know, and tried that play. And then in 2012, I guess it was a form of a midlife crisis. I thought, well, this story still seems beautiful to you after 20 years. Could you just give yourself a break and try it? Even if you messed it up, if 2 years vanish, nobody's going to notice, you know? And it was a bit of a feeling of like, if I didn't do it, it would be because I was too afraid of it. And I would go back to doing what I knew, which felt like a kind of a death sentence artistically. So it was in a life that's pretty busy and in which it would be easy to distract myself with certain successes, I'm proud of myself for that little moment, because I did look sort of straight at myself and said, look, you have a decision to make. Do you want to grow the rest of your life or do you want to shrink? Mm-hmm. You know, and mm-hmm. And in that one rare occasion, I made a good decision and decided to.
Creative writing students are always told how important it is to find your voice. Mm-hmm. Well, there's one thing that isn't in this book. There is no one voice,
right?
Which is so extraordinary for a novel, and I'm sure a huge part of why it's won this amazingly prestigious prize, because it really has smashed the form in many ways.
Yeah, I think one of the things I discovered through the book, and I guess I've always believed this, but this book is kind of an embodiment of it, is that any one person has access to, I'm going to say, every person. Now, I don't know if that's literally true, but that means that if I say, could I do a 97-year-old Auschwitz survivor? Of course. You know, that's the assumption. Now, whether it's true or not, I don't know, but it's an exciting assumption. Mm. And I think it's based on, in Buddhism, you know, the idea that everybody has, the way they put it, is everyone has Buddha nature. So that means you and I and everyone in the world has exactly the same lovely dollop of eternal luminosity, you know. Now, it gets loaded up with everything, your personhood, with your identity suite, you know, your gender, your all that, and it gets loaded up with habitual thought and bad habits and all of that. But in certain modes, we can get access to that core, prayer, meditation, and I think fiction, reading and writing. When I write something and you read it or vice versa, if we're doing our job right, all of that sort of yucky cloaking of habit gets dropped off, and that beautiful core in me reaches that core in you. That's an intensely hopeful thing. And a corollary of that is that any person can actually, to some degree of tolerance, imagine someone else's experience and represent it. Yeah.
And there are so many experiences within this book. Just give us a little snapshot of then how it unfolds, how all these voices come together, what they're doing in the bardo, and their kind of language that they use. Because they don't, for instance, they don't use the word coffin. They don't really refer to death. It's very interesting.
Right. Most of the characters in the book are, I guess we'd call them ghosts approximately, although I don't really picture them as ghostly, but they're spirits. They're in this place because at the moment of death, they just weren't ready. They were unhappy, or they were too happy, or they were in love, or, you know, all the millions of reasons that someone might want to stay in this realm. So they kind of locked up and they refused to go on. And one of the ways that they continue to stay in this kind of precarious condition is just to repeat their stories over and over again. And, you know, I just realized recently that I had done a story about 6 years ago where I lived in a homeless camp in Fresno, California, incognito for a week. And that had so much to do with this book because there...
A kind of purgatory.
Exactly right. Yeah. Mm. It was a confined physical space in a train yard. And the people there would find me and they could sense that there was something different about me, even though I wasn't bathing and, you know, and they would tell me their stories. Sometimes four or five times in the day, sometimes in the same exact words. And always these stories were full of longing for the world that they had left behind, you know, the world of functional, you know. These are people who are sort of stuck in this place and they have to tell themselves this fiction that they're not dead. They're just sick or they're in some other place. And it, you know, it's literally like a verbal cueing. They won't say my coffin. They'll say my sick box. And so it's a little bit of a kind of a running joke. Mm. But for them, it's quite serious.
Of course, central to this is a president. And in the time that it's taken you to write this book, there have been many presidents. And I wonder if the political climate, the changing political climate, influenced the writing of the book.
It was finished before the Trump era. And I think it's funny because when I was writing it during Obama, I had a sense that, well, history is nice, but it's done. And then we see that actually, in the States, the Civil War actually never ended. It was never done correctly. So it was, for me, before the Trump thing happened, the book made me sort of, I don't know, patriotic might be the right word, but it made me realize that these historical things were so much more chaotic than we think. You know, the fact that Lincoln was such a conflicted person and he had, you know, he was, 50 years old when this was going on. He lost his son. He was killing tens of thousands of people a day through his ineptitude, actually. So that was all very alive in my mind. And then the book came out and Trump won, or vice versa. Trump won, the book came out, and I went on the road with it. And so suddenly America just seemed vital. And I don't know what it is anymore. You know, I think I always thought that America was this wonderful car that went down this virtuous road and occasionally went into a ditch. Now, to be honest, it's a bit reversed. I think maybe we've been in a ditch quite a bit, and occasionally we came up onto the road. Mm. But the book sort of made me see the country as a vital, organic thing and a story that isn't at all finished yet. And it could have a very happy ending or it could have a horrific ending, and it's sort of in our hands even as we speak.
What can we do?
Good question. What I have concluded is that the first thing we have to do is recognize that the car stays on the road through millions of small, decent acts. Small, you know, acts where we say, no matter what happens, we know love is still love, cruelty is still cruelty, oppression is still oppression.
And we're back to empathy. Yeah.
Yes, and we're not going to be dissuaded. It doesn't matter how insane the world gets. We're going to sort of be artists and say, all right, if the world seems crazy to me, that's on me. It's on me to expand my understanding, but also not to budge, you know, not to normalize, not to sort of laugh it off or despair it off. In some ways, it's not a very grand solution, but I think in the States right now, we're in danger of getting tired and then letting it normalize. But nobody I know who is a progressive person who has any doubt of how wrong this is. So the thing is, if we can have confidence that by doing whatever we do with renewed energy, if you're a painter, paint. If you're a complainer, complain. You know, if you're a weightlifter, I think the thing is to activate. And as a writer, I think it's never been more vital. We're in this condition in the States because we let education go down the drain. And so vast numbers of people can hear what Trump says and not recognize it as BS. That's an educational problem. Mm. And we've also been cross-educated by the right-wing media, but our tolerance of right-wing media is a symptom of poor education. So these are not mysterious problems. You know, the antidote is pretty clear. And, you know, it's funny. I've loved art my whole life, but I noticed in the last 6 months that I took it seriously in my writing room, but was perfectly willing to not take it seriously out there, you know, to accept that, well, most people, well, why would they read a literary book, you know? Now, suddenly I'm thinking, what a fool I was. You know, this process that we love of deeply going into the mind of another person, it's food and water, you know? And without it, we get ourselves into these insane situations that we're in now, and people suffer because of it. So, you know, I think a lot of artists and people who write about art, we have a shtick that we do about the importance of stories, you know, and we just do it automatically. But what an amazing dramatization of that is going on right now in the world, you know? If we forfeit this most vital way of knowing the mind of another, then we stop knowing the minds of others and we start trampling on them, you know? So I'm kind of more fired up about art than I have ever been in my life, and I've been been pretty fired up about it in the past.
And so what's next for you, and what's next for America?
For me, I'm just going to go back and try to write a short story, because that's always been kind of the prayer for me, is to just try to write a little six-page something or other and don't get too grandiose. For America, I think actually part of the essential morality of this moment is to keep saying we don't know. You know, you watch TV in America, everybody knows what's happening until the next day when they have to revise it. So I think, again, for me, the artistic mind is to say, we actually don't know. Isn't that interesting? Something unprecedented is happening there. In a certain way, the dark forces at work, they thrive on a pundit class that continually knows, because then they can simply reverse direction and confuse everybody. So I think the thing I'm kind of committed to, one is this Man Booker Prize apparently is kind of a big deal. So I'm resolved to use it virtuously, you know, if I get a bigger platform, to try to use it energetically and virtuously. And also just to keep an open mind so that as the data comes in, it doesn't confuse us. You know, I think if you look back at historical periods where fascist impulses prevailed, the liberal class had blinders on. And those blinders are often made of pre-existing concepts. I'm just trying to keep those blinders off and see what's actually happening and, you know, respond accordingly.
George Saunders, thank you so much
thank
for
you
talking
so much.
To me. Lincoln in the Bardo is published by Bloomsbury. It won the Man Booker Prize 2017. You've been listening to The Big Interview with George Saunders, the winner of the Man Booker Prize 2017. To hear interviews with the past two winners, Paul Beattie and Marlon James, head over to our literary programme Meet the Writers, where, as well as award winners, you'll find an archive of over 100 conversations I've had with a diverse range of international authors. The Big Interview was put together by the team of Fernando Pacheco, Cassie Galpin, Katie Watkins, Alessio Del Anna, and Chloe Karnitsis. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.